everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I have a great show planned for you today. My guest will be Darryl Benjamin. He is the co-author of a new book called Farm to Table, The Essential Guide. The Essential Guide to Sustainable Food Systems for Students, Professionals, and Consumers. And it's a great, great handbook to really can help people learn how to connect the dots with our complicated food system. And I'll tell you more about him in just a little bit when he comes on. But first, I want to share with all of you some things going on in and around the news and my weekly recipe. And of course, some things, events coming up. So, first, I just want to tell you all that those listening, that I feel your pain. I mean, every day when we open the paper and we see the policies that Trump is undoing, that were there set up to protect us in our food system, in our environment, and he's just unraveling it and really working hard. And we have to work hard to stand up against that. And it will take every single one of us. And so we really can't become apathetic and lethargic in this area. We really need to mobilize and stay connected. And there's lots of organizations helping us to do that. Right now, you know, he's trying to unravel the EPA water safety rule and set that back. He's delaying our food labeling laws. He is just, you know, he's building up the military and cutting Medicaid and safety net programs that help those that are really struggling to make ends meet. I heard a really interesting statistic that just blew me away, that 48% of the people in this country make $15 or less per hour. And I just found that astounding. And when I think that there's people that are making even less than that, it's just impossible to try to make ends meet and to provide for your family when you're really struggling to pay your rent, buy your food, have medical needs met. So we all really need to stand up against the policies that Trump is trying to push down our throats. So there's lots of ways that you can do that. I have lots of great information on my website and petitions that you can sign and phone numbers to call your senators and representatives and governors to try to really prevent these policies from happening. And starting locally is really probably the best way right now to really hone in on know who your representatives are, know who your state senators are, show up in Albany or wherever your state is, and let your elected representatives know how you feel. So I also want to talk to you, I do every year this time of year when we're out in the sun and we're eating fresh fruits and vegetables, hopefully shopping at farmers markets or growing our own, that there are wonderful guides to help us navigate the higher quality products. And sometimes, you know, people say that they can't afford organic, that it's too expensive, and I hear you. But there are lists out there, I'm specifically thinking of the Dirty Dozen list that the Environmental Working Group puts out, that can help you guide to what products you really want to focus in on and hone in on that you want to buy organic. And this year on the Dirty Dozen list, our strawberries are at the top of the list, which seem to be at the top of the list every year because they are so heavily sprayed. So you want to get local strawberries that are not sprayed. If they're not organic, it's okay, but talk to the farmer and make sure that they're not sprayed. Spinach is number two. Nectarines, apples, peaches, pears, cherries, grapes, lots of the fruit, and lots of the fruit where you eat the skin. Celery, tomatoes, sweet bell peppers, potatoes, and hot peppers. Those you really want to make an effort to buy organic. And the other thing I'd like to talk about is as we're lathering on that sunscreen to protect ourselves from the ultraviolet rays, we also need to think about the fact that the skin is not benign. It is actually an organ. It is our largest organ in our body, and it absorbs everything. And so when you put sunscreen on, You're doing yourself a service if you're getting a sunscreen that is a high-quality sunscreen that does not have toxic chemicals in it. But you have to think about what is in that sunscreen that you are lathering all over your body, or even worse, your child's body. And so I want to share with you that the Environmental Working Group also has a wonderful list of sunscreen products, and it really rates them as to which ones meet their criteria in safety and healthy ingredients. So check that out before you purchase your sunscreen. And if you have some of the ones that they really recommend are bad, or not recommend, that they isolate as being bad and toxic, throw them out. Get rid of them, and really, you know, make a commitment to buying brands that are toxic-free. Another great organization that has great lists is cornucopia.org. You know, there's been a lot of writing up of milk and our eggs, and even ones that say they're organic might not be, because our Organic Standards Board has been infiltrated by these big corporations, and so they're not necessarily doing their job. So thank God we have these nonprofit organizations that are really working to help protect us, and I just want to share that information with all of you so that you know them and you can tap in and benefit from them as well. Some great things going on in and around our area. Slow Food East End is having their community potluck dinner this evening at Bridge Gardens in Bridgehampton. The weather's not great, so check in with the Slow Food East End website and see if the potluck is going on or if there's a rain date. Also, let's see, July 8th, there's a big event, a rose tasting at Jamesport Manor out on the East End. July 9th, beekeeping inspection class at the Brooklyn Grange. This is from 2 to 4 on Sunday, this weekend. Brooklyn Grange is a wonderful rooftop farm. Our local Slow Food chapter took a little trip there and had a tour a couple weeks ago, and it was just wonderful. Anyway, they keep bees up there, as well as some other rooftops throughout the city, and they're going to talk about how to get started and a little bit about beekeeping 101, so check that out. Also at Brooklyn Grange on July 12th, they're having a compost dinner. We've talked a lot about food waste over the years, and it's something that's really coming into mainstream for people to think about how to use the parts of vegetables and I guess they also meat and fish. I don't know if this is a vegetarian event or not, but you can check out the website and find out. But anyway, using the parts of food that we don't usually use and how to turn that into delicious food. I know I've been using beet tops and radish green tops a lot in making these wonderful pâtés that I have shared the recipe with you before. You can find it on my website. But they're great. You know, and I used to just, you know, buy the beets and take the tops and throw them out. And I used to do the same with the radish greens. And it's wonderful to know that that's all edible now. Not now, it always was, but I just didn't know about it. I'm heading out to Denver in a couple weeks, actually in just a week now. July 14th through the 16th, Slow Food Nation is taking place in Denver, Colorado. And that is a huge slow food event, similar to Terra Madre that happens in Turin, Italy every other year. This is going to be a big gathering of food leaders and eaters, farmers, chefs, educators. There will be panel discussions, workshops, seminars, dinners, tours. They're closing down streets and having big, you know, block parties on the street and a huge tasting marketplace. So if you are a foodie and you have the time, this is a place you want to be. So come on out to Denver. It's a free event, although there are certain programs that you have to buy tickets to that cost extra. But you could come and just eat your way through a full weekend of deliciousness. So I hope to see some of you there. City Growers is having a summer series of workshops on Saturdays. And the first one is July 22nd, and it's in Long Island City. And City Growers, you know, brings people together to have community gardens, and they will be they will be talking about the homeopathic properties of herbs. And Sarah Hurwitz works with city growers, and she's an educator, and she'll be talking about the holistic benefits of using different herbs. And there will be some herbal craft tea from Brooklyn Grange there as well. So this is at the Brooklyn Grange in Northern Boulevard in Long Island City. So they also have one in Brooklyn and one in Long Island City. And the Food Truck Derby is coming up August 11th out in Bridgehampton. That's always a fun event at the Hayground School in Bridgehampton. Mark your calendars for that. Up in the Boston area, there's an organization called the Food Project at the Summer Institute. And this is an organization that brings young people together for personal and social change through sustainable agriculture. Great organization in eastern Massachusetts. If you know anyone that would benefit from that program, check it out. It's August 3rd through the 5th. And lots of other events. I just want to ask you to save the date for September 9th. My local slow food chapter, we're having a family fun day. We're showing a film called What's on Your Plate and doing a vegetarian sushi making workshop. And this is a family event. So save the date. It'll be at the Cinema Arts Center in Huntington. And there's a fall potluck the next day, September 10th, at Restoration Farm, which is our local organic community farm that has a CSA and is doing such great work for the community. So check that out. Lots of other events, but I don't want to take the time to talk to you about all of them because there's just too many. So check them out on my website at ieatgreen.com. But what I do want to share with you is my recipe right now. You know, this time of year, we're all about fruits and berries, and peaches are coming into season soon. Ones from the south are coming up, and mine are not ready yet, but I'm watching them grow every day and can't wait. So in anticipation of the peaches coming in out on the East End and such, this is a peach blueberry pie. Blueberries are also in season. They're actually some places already going out of season, but make sure you get the blueberries also organic, or you can get wild blueberries from Maine. They're not sprayed either, and they're delicious. So this is not a vegan recipe, although, of course, you can always substitute it. If you want to know how to make a vegan vegetarian crust, look at some of my other recipes, and you can substitute that out. But the blueberry peach part is vegan. So you can just substitute that out or just do it crustless and just do it in a pie pan without any crust and put a crumb topping on that's vegan. Okay, so this crust is 2 cups of organic whole wheat pastry flour, 2 cups of organic unbleached white flour, 2 teaspoons salt, 2 sticks plus 2 tablespoons unsalted butter, and 1/2 cup plus 2 tablespoons of cold water. And the filling, you'll want 6 to 7 organic peaches that you blanch, and that helps you to remove the skin really easily, and then you slice it up. 1 Granny Smith apple that you peeled and grated. 1 pint of fresh organic blueberries. 1/3 cup honey or organic sugar, or you could use maple syrup. 1 tablespoon lemon juice. 1 1/2 teaspoon cinnamon. And 3 tablespoons organic white flour. So to make the crust, you're going to start by putting the 2 flours into a large bowl. You can also make this gluten-free. If you want to just substitute gluten-free flour, you can do that. And with a pastry knife, you're going to cut in the butter until all the butter is incorporated and it looks like little pebbles. Then make a well in the center and pour in your ice water. And using your hands, you want to fluff the flour up from the outer ridges into the center so that you're not mixing it with a spoon, but you're actually kind of tumbling the flour and the water together until it forms a dough. And from that, you're going to make 2 balls for the crust. And you're going to spread some flour on your countertop and roll out the ball, one of the balls of dough. And I actually have a little video of that on my website. Actually, I have to look. I know I have it. I have to make sure it's up there for you. But, you know, the way that I roll out my dough is I flatten it into a flat disc. And then as I'm pressing down on the top, I'm pushing in on the sides to keep the edges from splintering off. And it keeps it round as you roll out the dough. And that's very helpful in the process. And so you're going to roll it out until it's a few inches larger than your pie pan. And then you can just sprinkle a little bit of flour on the top of the dough, fold the dough in half, and pick the dough up and put it onto half of the pie pan and then unfold it so that the other half of the pie crust goes onto the pie pan and makes a full crust. And then you're going to leave it hanging over the edge because you're going to, of course, put the other crust on top. And so after you do that, then you will pinch them. So just let it sit there for a minute. For the filling, you're going to combine all the ingredients into a large bowl and then add that into the bottom crust. And then to finish it, you're going to roll out the top crust again. And it's your choice whether you want to make a lattice top or you just want to make another pie shell top. If you want to do a lattice one, just Google it, and I'm sure you can find how to lattice. I'm not going to take the time to tell you that right now, but to roll out the other pie crust, and then I fold one quarter in and make six little slats so that when you open it, it looks like a little V shape. And then I do the same on the other side, and those are air pockets to allow the air to come out, and that keeps the crust crusty when it's baking, and so it doesn't steam. And then you're going to trim the crust that's hanging over the edge so that it's just about a half an inch hanging over the edge, and then roll it up, pinching the top and the bottom together. And then once you've rolled it up, then between your thumb and your index finger, you're going to pinch all the way around the edge to create a nice fluted edge of the crust. Brush the top with some egg yolk, and that just helps make it shiny. And then bake it at first at 425 for the first 15 minutes. That will seal the crust in, make it golden brown, and then bake it the rest of the way at 350 for about 30 more minutes until it starts bubbling through the top and you see the juices coming out. You really want it to be sweet. And the Granny Smith apple, you put it in there, it helps solidify the juices. It gives it a nice texture. So enjoy. This is a great time of year, and everything's coming out of the garden. So check out the recipes on my website. And now it's my pleasure to introduce to all of you my guest, Daryl Benjamin. Daryl co-wrote the book, The Farm to Table, The Essential Guide to Sustainable Food Systems for Students, Professionals, and Consumers with Lyndon Verkler. And this is a great handbook. It's something that is just full of so much information. It's separated into two parts. The first part is about the farm, and the second part is more about the table. And Daryl is, in addition to being an author, he is passionate about sustainable food, and he is also a professor right now online at the Green Mountain College, as well as teaching English at Norwich University. And he holds an MFA in writing, as well as a Certificate of Leadership in Sustainable Food Systems from the University of Vermont. And he is also the principal of the GMO Breakthrough Education Project, which is a nonprofit dedicated to transforming global food systems through education. And he is just a mover and a shaker, and I'm so pleased to have him on. Ben, Daryl, are you with me?
It's my pleasure to be here with you.
Thank you. Well, your book is just full of so much wonderful information. But before we go dive into the book, can you tell us a little bit of how you got started in the sustainable food movement?
Certainly. I'd be happy to. And thank you for your complimentary words about the book. Our goal for writing the book was really to connect the dots and give people an overall picture of what sustainable food systems are and the challenges to them and possible solutions. So to answer your question, well, I guess I've always been interested in food justice. My first year of college, I organized a student boycott of iceberg lettuce because of worker abuse. And I received a personal thank you letter from Cesar Chavez that I'm very proud of. More recently, I taught food and agricultural sustainability for 7 years at New England Culinary Institute in Montpelier, Vermont. And I blog at University of Vermont's food feed site. And as you mentioned, I am teaching at Green Mountain College. But what's really exciting to me are going to the conferences on sustainable food and delivery workshops, because that gets the word out.
Absolutely. I love going to those conferences. But sometimes I feel like we're just talking to the people that already know. The people that are at the conferences are the ones that already are in the movement.
That is certainly a problem, and we'll talk more about that. But certainly that's a challenge. However, if it motivates one person to support a green nonprofit, then I suppose it's worth its value. Also, it leads to other connections. For example, at one of the conferences, I was invited to speak in a college classroom, which really got the students motivated. So,
Maybe for those that are listening and are not so familiar with the concepts of farm-to-table thinking, maybe you can just share a little bit of the basic ideas behind that farm-to-table
Certainly.
Thinking.
A sustainable approach to farming is economically viable, environmentally sound, and socially beneficial. It works for the farmer, the land, and the community. Farm-to-table thinking is a collective notion of fair, fresh, affordable, and accessible food. It's largely a social movement which promotes local food linked directly to restaurants and other outlets. The emphasis is on whole food and pure, fresh food, which is unprocessed. Purity can be defined as nothing added or subtracted. That's whole food.
Mm-hmm. Right, because, you know, I always find there's certain people that come to eating plant-based or being vegan from an animal advocacy side and are not necessarily thinking of the health benefits that one can get from eating whole plant-based food. And I think the farm-to-table movement is really bringing that into the forefront, that it's really real food. It's not processed food, because there's a lot of processed food that might qualify as vegan, but it's certainly not healthy for you.
Yes, it's, you know, the definition of real food is a challenge, because there is so much food that is not real that it overwhelms that which is out there. So, you know, whole food is food as nature intended it, and it's in harmony with nature's patterns.
Mm-hmm. My next question I get asked a lot, and people are always asking me, which is better, local or organic? And people are confused sometimes between local and sustainable.
Right.
Or
yeah.
Local and organic, or, you know, some farmers' markets. You know, what always gets me is the farmers' markets that they set up in the food desert areas are not organic. You know, the organic farmers go down to Union Square or to the more
that
affluent
kind of
areas.
Point, doesn't it?
And the farmers that are doing the farmers' markets in the economically challenged communities very often are conventional farmers that are not. They might be local, but they're certainly not raising their vegetables in a sustainable way. So, can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, the difference really between local and sustainable. Local is a geographical description. Definitions will vary according to town, state, and region, so there's no single definition. Some say 20 miles, some say 100 or more, some say within the state. Sustainable is a completely different notion. It's a broader proposition. According to the Brundtland Report, which was commissioned by the UN in October of 87, sustainability is, quote, development that meets the needs of the present without compromising the ability of future generations to meet their own needs. So that's two concepts in there. The first is needs, which is really targeted to the world's poor, to which overriding priority should be given. And the idea of limitations imposed by the state of technology and social organization on the environment's ability to meet present and future needs. So it has those two concepts tucked into that definition. Listen, environmental resources are limited, but big ag companies like Monsanto, Cargill, and Nestle are extractive, which means they extract resources from the environment. That's unsustainable because the Earth's resources are finite. Farm-to-table specifically leans towards restorative food production techniques, which work in harmony with Earth's ecosystems.
Mm-hmm. And when you are asked by people which is better, local or organic, what do you recommend?
Which is better, local or organic? Well,
yes.
Organic means that it is certified. So it's actually, the purity is guaranteed. Local can also be just as good as organic. However, it's not tested in the same way. So I wouldn't say that I would recommend one above the other. I would say go to your farmer's market and talk to your farmer and ask them how the food is raised, or better yet, go to the farm itself and visit.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. And in your book, do you go into any of the certification processes that are going on? I know right now with so much food coming in from other countries, and you hear about, the organic standards even in this country being weakened and not having enough inspectors. How can people feel confident about the organic label when it's coming from other countries and even this country?
Well, I trust it when it comes from this country. I think it's still standing strong for organic certification. I also trust the non-GMO certification labeling, which is on products in your supermarket. Yes, we do discuss different kinds of certifications in the book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I also hear from so many of my clients or people I talk to about the fact that they just can't afford organic food. Can you justify why local and sustainable food is so much more expensive and yet why it's so much better?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, processed food is poorer in nutrition, and it often has pesticides, chemicals, and foreign ingredients from GMOs, genetically modified organisms. So, it is more expensive, and that is a challenge. And if you live in a food desert or you don't have the money, then it's a no-brainer to go with the cheaper food. However, cheaper food is processed. Cheaper food contributes to obesity and diabetes. Processed food, yes, it tastes great, doesn't it? But it's only cheap on the front end. It's expensive on the back end with hospital bills. So it is cumulative in your system. And we don't really know what effect it's having in our system because there is a lack of transparency in the manufacturing process. Cheaper food is generally found, by the way, in the center of your supermarket or in the aisles, and is generally in boxes or cans.
Right. And they generally have big health claims on the front. Low fat,
yeah.
Non-GMO. Well, non-GMO is a good one, but low fat, high fiber, you know, whatever the trend is that that they're trying to market to will be
exactly.
In bold letters. And that's the kind of food I always tell people you want to avoid.
The best thing to do is to look at the ingredients, read the ingredients. If you mm-hmm. see things that are unpronounceable chemicals, you know it's been adulterated.
Right. Absolutely. And in your book, you talk about why it's so important to know where your food comes from. Do you want to elaborate on that a little bit?
Yes. Having a relationship with your food, knowing where it comes from, really fosters health. Knowing where your food comes, it bridges the gap from farm to table. Children don't associate farms with what's on their table. The gap has grown really wide. Kids don't understand that cheese comes from cows anymore, or what a whole tomato or onion looks like. As Jamie Oliver showed in his Food Revolution video, I don't know if you've seen that.
Yes, I have.
From his anti-obesity project in Huntington, West Virginia. Having this connection develops a healthy relationship with food, allowing people to appreciate and respect its true value. It allows for the understanding of how vegetables are grown, how cows are raised, or how wheat flour is produced, and that eating shouldn't be a fast, mindless action, but rather experience which nourishes the body. Improving the relationship people have with food can help grow sustainable food systems by raising awareness of every step in the food chain and the value of unadulterated food. So packaged and processed foods means that you're buying impurities. Eating local means a smaller carbon footprint as well.
Right, right. And I know in the past, you know, for some of my listeners who are here every week, they certainly know about GMO foods, but I think there's still so many people out there, when I talk about it, they'll just say, what's GMO? Can you talk a little bit about what GMOs are, engineered foods, and why we have such concern about them?
Absolutely. You're absolutely right when you say that. You know, they've done surveys that have shown that people are wary of GMOs, but if you ask them what it is, they just don't know. And that's one of my missions. That's one of my hot spots that I concentrate on when I go to workshops. So engineered foods are produced by changing the DNA of food using genetic engineering. So it changes the DNA and it uses genetic engineering. Currently, there are three forms of GMOs out there. Just GMOs itself, DNA contains one or more genes not normally found there. So that's called transgenic. A high percentage of food crops such as corn and soybeans are genetically modified. For example, specific maize corn strains have been genetically engineered to express agriculturally desirable traits, including resistance to pests and to herbicides. Maize strains with both traits are now in use in multiple countries. The next one is nanofoods, which talks about nanoparticles being used in food right now. So nanoscience is the study of phenomena and manipulation of materials at atomic, molecular, and macromolecular scales, where properties differ significantly from those at a large scale. In other words, if you have a chunk of silver in your hand, you're looking at it, you feel it, you see it. But if you reduce it to the nanoscale, to nanoparticles, it's about the size of an atom, it actually passes through all of your blood barriers, including your brain blood barrier. So nanofoods are nanotechniques or tools used during cultivation, production, processing, or packaging of food. Just as a side interest, some of nanoproducts, which, by the way, are out there, but we don't know for sure what they're in because they're not required to be on ingredients lists. However, informed researchers have reported that it's most likely in almond beverages, candy, cereal, chocolate, chocolate syrup, coffee creamer, cookies, crackers, cream cheese, donuts, and so on, all the way down to yogurt. So it is a lot of products, and we're not being told that nanoparticles are in them. The last one I'll talk about is called CRISPR, or CRISPR, CAS9. Have you heard of CRISPR, Bhavani?
No. How do you spell it?
CRISPR. Well, let me tell you, the scientific community is on fire about this technology. In fact, Monsanto completely leapfrogged nano foods and went directly to CRISPR and received a exclusive license to use it. So what it is essentially a pair of molecular scissors for cutting DNA, so precise and easy to use that it has taken biology by storm. It deletes individual segments of DNA like a molecular scalpel. Companies like Calixt have portrayed gene editing more like moving the cursor in a word processor.
Oh, I have heard of that, yes.
And making a small change to the text.
Uh-huh.
So it's cheap,
ridiculous,
quick, and easy to use. It stands for clustered, regularly interspaced, short palindromic repeats, which is a mouthful. But basically, it makes precise mutations that disable whole genes or imprecise repairs that knock out gene function. So some agricultural applications are disease-resistant wheat and rice, dehorned cattle, disease-resistant goats, vitamin-enriched sweet oranges, and leaner pork. And some commercial product applications are for commodity crops, for example, DuPont and Caribou Biosciences are using CRISPR to create plants that are drought-resistant and produce higher yields. The new plants should hit the market in 5 to 10 years, remarkably faster than the 10 to 17 years it takes most biotech crops. So these products are being waved through untested. Bananas, the Cavendish banana, the most common type, is on the verge of extinction due to the fungal disease. But Korean researchers are attempting to save it using CRISPR to snip out the receptor that the fungus uses. And finally, pigs. A group of Chinese researchers have created a pig that is extra muscly so it can yield healthier cuts of pork, while American researchers have successfully edited pigs to make them resistant to porcine reproductive and respiratory syndrome, common disease that costs farmers $600 million per year. So there's even research to remove the hypoallergenic aspect of peanuts so that they'll be safe for everyone, allergy-free peanuts.
Mm-hmm.
So just concluding about engineered foods, is my concern with engineered products is twofold. On one hand, there's a lack of transparency. The public is not privy to the manufacturing process. As with GMOs, the strategy seems to be release into the food supply first, assess risks later.
Right,
and
that's the way our country does it.
On the other hand, there's a dramatic lack of testing before these products enter the market. Personally, I would feel comfortable after the product is tested for 100 years, about five generations. When you consider that farming has been evolving naturally for 10,000 years, what's a century to test man-made alterations just to be safe? Instead, there's a lack of regulation, a lack of oversight, and lack of public input. Products enter the market as quickly as the scientific community can transfer new techniques to big ag companies that take the ideas and bring it to market as quickly as they can. Both NanoFoods and CRISPR have only been around for under 10 years, GMOs a bit more. I believe the mantra of policymakers should be no data, no market.
Right. Well, one of the problems also is that the data that they do get is usually funded by the biotech companies. And so how much can you trust it anyway? And I know the FDA and the EPA are strapped for money, and they have no money for their testing. So they rely on industry testing to use it. And you know, when, you know, and all these biotech companies give so much money to colleges and universities that are doing the research and doing the testing. And if
absolutely, and that just fosters the cycle. In fact,
right.
It's very interesting. I don't know if you saw the article about the student at Cornell who is revealing all of
Oh, yes, I did. Uh-huh.
Wasn't
but no,
that
what I want you to share.
So
I'd love to share that story, Darryl.
Campaign of sustainable food against the traditional and very corporate-funded Cornell University faculty. And, you know, I give this guy a lot of credit. I admire him.
Mm-hmm. Me too. Darryl, let's take a couple-minute break, and when we come back, I would love some of your input on what you think consumers can do to protect themselves and fight back. So everyone listening, don't go anywhere. I'm talking with Darryl Benjamin, author of Farm to Table, The Essential Guide, and you're listening to Bhavani at IE Green. Be right back.
Excellent.
PRN.FM, bringing you new shows and fresh ideas every day. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
Given these complex times, we all need to connect the dots. And that's what we do on my show every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and I welcome environmentalists, thought leaders, media critics, advocates, health experts, and authors to an in-depth dialogue about how all facets of social choices impact health, food, and the environment. Check out all my past shows at PRN.fm in the show archives. There are some great thought leaders sharing their ideas and letting you know what you can do to change our world. Please join us.
Stay tuned for more news you can use on PRN, the Progressive Radio Network.
Everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network, and I'm talking today with Darryl Benjamin, author of his latest book, Farm to Table, The Essential Guide to Sustainable Food Systems for Students, Professionals, and Consumers. And right before the break, we were just talking about the new forms of genetically engineered foods, which are so scary, and I was asking him, what can consumers do? So, Darryl, are you with me again?
Absolutely.
Great. So can you talk to us a little bit, what can consumers do to protect themselves from these nanofoods? How do they know which foods have them? Because it seems like that's part of the hidden secret.
Yeah. Well, it's at this point, if you're buying off the shelf from your supermarket, it's quite difficult to find what's in it, as there is no requirement for reporting. So it's not a feature that corporations would like to put on labels. It's
right.
Incentive to buy the product. So what can consumers do? The first and most important thing is to not feel overwhelmed. And it's easy, considering the complexity of the food chain and all the steps, to feel like it's so dominated by corporations and government complicity that one person cannot make a difference. And, of course, this is false. We know that from so many examples in our own American history, how one person has made a difference. If enough people stand up, one of them perhaps will turn the tide. We need a paradigm shift. What consumers can do is go to farmers markets, which allows for direct interaction with customers, the ability to build a base of regular customers for farmers over time. That helps farmers gain a sense of their community's preferences and plan future crops. So increasing your commitment to your community is very important. Community-supported agriculture is a great opportunity for direct marketing between farmers, producers, and consumers. farmers benefit because CSA members pay their membership fee at the beginning of the season, providing cash for early season expenses and reducing the needs for loans. They also benefit from having a guaranteed market for their product, allowing the better season for better season planning. Members benefit from access to fresh local food, connecting to a local farmer, and the knowledge that they're directly supporting the local farm economy. CSA shares, when averaged out over the growing season, are also usually less expensive than shopping at the farmer's market. Another thing you can do is take your family on agritourism excursions. That provides an opportunity for farmers to create yet another revenue stream on the farm. The idea here is to support small and mid-sized farmers as a counter movement to the industrial model. So agritourism offers a public a chance to connect with our ancestral agricultural heritage. So mainstream interest in farms are growing. Many people from urban and suburban areas are looking to experience what life on the farm is like. It's a blend of tourism, entertainment, and education. It takes a variety of forms. For example, events can be focused around a theme like harvest or seasonal events. Guided farm tours can share the farm experience, giving visitors an overview of the farm, animals, and crops. Themed farm tours are also a way to partner with other producers. Guests visit multiple farms, all celebrating a product, like artisan cheese, for example, complete with tastings and a picnic lunch. Mm-hmm. And finally, farms can also provide educational and experiential opportunities. On-farm workshops or classes in subjects like cheese making, chicken farming, cider pressing, or composting will attract many visitors. Visitors pick their own fruits and vegetables at a reduced case or bushel price are often a big draw to these farms. And experiential farm activities can take a number of other forms, like demos of farm chores to get visitors actively involved for a couple of hours or half for a whole day. Some farms integrate bed and breakfast concept where visitors stay on the farm and may or may not participate in farm activities. Finally, the destination weddings on the farm are a strong trend in agritourism. Many farms have converted large old barns into beautiful wedding venues.
Mm-hmm.
That's a
yeah, they are beautiful to have a wedding there. I wanted to ask your opinion about or really talk about some of the issues in the food justice movement because, you know, one of the trends that I've been seeing is a lot of, where CSAs was really big a few years ago, they're having a hard time keeping their customers because a lot of people are going towards the delivery system. How can food or farmers benefit from the delivery system? Like, is there a way can they coordinate a CS model or combine a CS model in with these delivery food services?
Are you talking about like to a residence, delivery to residences?
Yes, it seems like a lot of people who had been doing the CSAs are now choosing to, whether it's Amazon Fresh or
some of the
delivery services come with a menu and they're just a certain amount of food, but other ones are full boxes of like a delivery of a CSA.
Right, like a bento box. Well, one thing that can be done is to insist on perhaps local or organic food, and that will definitely send a message to the owners. It's interesting you mentioned that because yesterday I saw a video from a company of an automated mobile truck that is that delivers, I think it was processed food, to your door, accessible by your iPhone, by your smartphone. So it actually comes to your door, this whole big truck, and it's all automated. You go inside, you scan your purchases, and then you leave, and you pay with your iPhone. Yes.
Is there a driver, there's not even a driver?
Not even a driver, correct.
Oh, that's weird. That's scary.
Yeah. They say that's coming out in about half a year. So the goals of food justice is to resolve problems of hunger and malnutrition, food insecurity, and environmental deterioration while achieving the systemic changes needed for sustainable, equitable, and democratic food systems. There is no single solution, unfortunately, as we've pointed out. It's complex interactions between interdependent steps and movements. However, we can understand it by just thinking of this is the age of specialization, concentration, centralization, and globalization. And I think as the progressive agenda is trying to take the opposite end of that. So it's challenges to the environment, to diet and health, and social inequality. Underneath environment, we have soil and water, land use, and climate change issues. Under diet and health, we have healthy food access, diet-related illness, food safety, and antibiotic resistance. Under social inequality, we have farm workers, meat processing workers, factory farm workers, and restaurant workers. So that's the paradigm that we're fighting against. The what is now called traditional is, in fact, the industrial food system.
Yeah. Yeah, it's so hard. Like at the beginning of the show, I talked about how many people in this country make under $30,000 a year to live on
for
their family.
That was a shocking statistic that you mentioned.
Yeah.
Absolutely. It's not a livable wage. Right.
And half the country is making that, you know, and so it's really, I try to really promote people starting to grow their own food, you know, that's a way to,
We're promoting the wrong things by giving subsidies to the wrong things, which is industrially grown corn, soybeans, et cetera. Instead, the subsidies should be going to fresh fruit and vegetables so that they are more affordable. One reason people are saying food is organic or healthy or local food is not affordable is because it's not subsidized by the government.
Right. Right. If we, if the industrial food people had to pay for the cleanup to the environment that they're causing, yeah, had to pay some of the health bills of the people that they're making sick,
yeah,
all of a sudden, organic food would be much cheaper than
absolutely
the industrial food.
And the country would be healthier, and hospital bills would go down. People would be healthier.
Well, the only way that that's going to happen is if we go to a universal health care, because then mm-hmm. our government would reap the benefits of people being healthier. Right now, they're reaping the benefits of people being sick. It's good business.
Yes,
you know, I hate to be such a skeptic and downer, but, you know, I think, you know, our government has no incentive to try to make their people healthy. You know, it works out okay for them when we're sick, because then we use hospitals, then we use doctors, then we use pharmacies. We
exactly
buy the bad food. And, you know, that's why, you know, I want to really recommend your book to so many people, because you really help to connect the dots so that people
exactly
understand how all these things are connected. And
has
your book gotten into any universities, or has it become a textbook, a required reading for many?
I believe it has been adopted. It's hard to tell exactly from the scanty statistics I receive, except for maybe once every half year from the publisher. But the book is selling well. So
good. Well, everybody, the book is called Farm to Table, The Essential Guide to Sustainable Food Systems for Students, Professionals, and Consumers. You can find it on Amazon. You can find it at your local bookstore, hopefully. Ask for it at your local bookstore. It's nice to support your local bookstore as well. But, Daryl, thank you so much for joining us. It's been really wonderful. Are you doing book tours?
It's been a pleasure, and may I just read a brief quote to conclude?
Sure.
This is from Masanobu Fukuoka, and he says, "When it is understood that one loses joy and happiness in the attempt to possess them, the essence of natural farming will be realized. The ultimate goal of farming is not the growing of crops, but the cultivation and perfection of human beings."
Beautiful.
Thank you.
Really beautiful.
Thank you so much.
You're so welcome. Everyone out there, thank you so much for joining us. It's been wonderful. Have a great rest of the week. I hope you all had a nice 4th of July, and I'll see you all again next week. Bye for now.